Welcome to Northeast Colorado Talks here on Farm Radio 1010 KSIR and KSIR.com. I'm Chris Brom. Our guest today, State Representative Dusty Johnson, joins us. Good morning, Dusty. How are you?
Morning and happy Friday. I'm doing pretty good. And yourself?
Off to a good start so far. It is Friday, another week nearly in the books, and one day closer to the new special session for the state legislature.
Yeah, one day closer, and as we get closer, we're trying to figure out as much information as we can to know what we're about to get into, and unfortunately, many of the members are tight-lipped on what their bills are, so it's going to be a lot of learning on the fly, which is never, in my opinion, good legislation when it's, honestly, we had 48 hours after we got the call on special for a scope on what we can and can't do. After that 48 hours, we have until end of today to pull what that bill is before it has to start being finalized. And then we go into special session with little to no stakeholding.
I was just saying, not only is it going in and learning on the fly, but doing so in a very truncated timeline. It's condensed down to just a few short days rather than a normal session where you have days and even weeks to sort through things.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because if we're honestly, if we're supposed to be the people's government, but then the people, it's going to be very hard for them to try to get informed in 3 days, especially out here. I mean, I try to keep people updated as much as I can, but by the time I update you, things have changed. And so trying to get people to come in to testify or trying to get feedback is going to be very hard in a minimum of 3 days. My guess is we do 5. I've heard people say we do 7. But that's still a very short process.
Without a doubt. Now, for those who may not recall or haven't caught the news yet, we talked a little bit on Monday with State Senator Byron Pelton about this. The focus of this special session is to discuss the roughly $1 billion shortfall for the state budget this coming fiscal year, correct?
Correct. Well, that's one of the scopes. So yeah, fiscal is one of the topics. Medicaid cuts as it relates to a healthcare enterprise and abortion funding in conflict between the federal and state is the second. Third is the SNAP, the food insurance program for school lunches. And then the fourth is artificial intelligence. So we not only get to look at one topic with trying to figure out a $1 billion cut need, we're also looking at 3 other topics at the same time.
Wow, I'm glad I asked, because I didn't realize how broad the scope was. I knew AI and the budget shortfall were two of the things. I didn't realize that there were 4 total. So yeah, not only do you have a much shorter timeline to tackle these things, but you've got to multitask and cover a rather large array of items. None of those things, maybe outside of the Medicaid and SNAP stuff, kind of ties into the budget. But other than that, none of them really relate to one another.
They don't. And I mean, you can even argue the budget doesn't fully as well when we're looking at what's going on federally and then at the state level. And then you have the conflict between whether we will get federal or not funds because of what the state has been doing. Where does that put local? And then do we have unfunded mandates after this on top of trying to cut things so we have a balanced budget?
Let's start with the budget piece, because I think that's the biggest thing that folks are focusing on or at least perhaps fretting over is, I mean, you're talking $1 billion difference in the budget. That's not a small chunk of change. Obviously, the average Joe can't really comprehend what $1 billion looks like. So how do you go about trimming away a $1 billion deficit in a short period of time?
Well, it's going to be painful, and it's going to be, I'm honestly not sure how we do it. We just had to cut $1.2 billion, so roughly about the same, but we had 120 days to do it. Now we have to cut almost the same amount in 3 to 7 days. We're going to be looking, I say we as the legislation, at where can other cuts happen, where can other, you know, funds be found. I'm not sure how many more funds we can find, because they pretty much pulled every single penny they could that they could actually do constitutionally, arguably, this last session. So my biggest fear is now they're going to go after Tabor, and that's going to be on the discussions of they're going to go after Tabor money, which is the people's money. And how does that look as we move forward?
I know when I talked with Byron on Monday, in previous conversations I've had with folks involved in legislation, in particular Greg Brophy, former state senator Greg Brophy, who keeps a close watch on things. His thought initially was that state Democrats would avoid taxing tips and overtime at the state level because of the political appearance, but it sounds like that's probably not going to be the case, that they're probably going to look at taxing both tips and overtime in an effort to try to make up some of that funding deficit. Is that right?
I don't know. I think Honorable Brophy might still be on to, at least from the limited conversations I've had with some Democrats, I think they're going to be putting it on to businesses, corporations, and trying to make make companies pay before they go for the workers to avoid that political aspect, especially in a tough governor race coming up. It's an election cycle coming up. I think they go for businesses before they go for workers.
That's interesting. I'll be curious to see how that plays out. Dusty, from your perspective, I know you mentioned that a lot of the money has already been, you know, quote unquote, found where it can be found, and cuts have happened. Are there some other cuts that you feel would be acceptable to help make up that difference without greatly impacting the state in general?
I think if we could start looking at targeting some of these special projects, or even projects that have kind of seen the end of their day and they're more now just administrative ones, then looking at it, now we have a very small window to see if it actually is possible. But I think it's almost it's over $3 million for this wolf reintroduction that we did this last budget to appropriate for more wolves coming in. I'm not a lawyer, but it's my understanding that we've already met the legal component of the ballot initiative when people said we should reintroduce, because there was no number saying we had to reintroduce five times. We had to reintroduce six times. We've reintroduced so many times that I think we could pull from that fund and at least help with some of the shortfall. And if we could look at some of those special projects that way, that have already been allocated this last year and now put them into what we need to rebalance the budget, it's going to be less painful for Colorado.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, I mean, there was no limit on how many times the state had to reintroduce wolves, and I don't believe there was a number of the amount of wolves they had to reintroduce either, if memory serves. So, without those particulars in place, I would imagine maybe there's a chance to shave some money there. Enough about the budget and coming up with, you know, $1 billion to cover that hole. You mentioned Medicaid and SNAP benefits as it pertains to school lunches. What's the conversation around those two?
And so this is where the governor is very much tied our hands, because when we were hearing conversations in the special session for over 2 weeks, it was just on Medicaid in general, where our funds going to be lost, where our patients going to lose, you know, these benefits. This scope now is Medicaid cuts as it relates to providers who offer abortion. And so we're now back in the conversation of, it's not the taxpayer responsibility, in my belief, that we pay for abortions through taxpayer dollars. Colorado disagrees. There was a bill last year that said that it should, that we should use taxpayer dollars to fund abortions. So now we have to come back and see, how do we offer, where does Medicaid fall into that, if that's something we need to still provide to the people. So we're going to look at very controversial issues like that. When we look at SNAP, we have been over allocating to the food free lunch program. It is something that people pass. We should be doing it and offering the free lunches to people. But there needs to be an opt-out provision that we have not allowed for, if a parent wants to have free reign on their kid's food. If they want Timmy to bring in a lunch every single day, then why does the school have to make him a lunch that's going to be tossed every single day? And so for them to say that we have a shortfall when we have a lot of food going into the trash cans just doesn't match up.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it that way as a parent with kids in school. There isn't any sort of option to say, hey, I appreciate the offer for the free meals. That's fantastic. Like my kids, for instance, just to use a personal example, both of my kids have celiac disease, which means they cannot have gluten. And so they take their lunches to school every single day. And so they don't eat school lunches, yet we still fill out the form and provide our income and all of those things for the free lunch program, even though it's not something that we partake in.
Right, and that's where we have a lot of waste. We have a lot of waste because it's parent choice. It's great to have the option for the families who can't afford it, but the families who don't need it, why are we still telling the lunch crew, we have 50 students in the building, make 50 lunches. Five of them don't need the lunch. They bring their own. Another 10 are going to be gone for an FFA conference the whole week. We have 15 lunches going in the trash. And now we're saying we still don't have enough money to fund it. And I'm like, well, if we didn't waste it, we could actually have a balance. It would work out.
Now, I do know, like, at the elementary level, I subbed at a couple of the elementary schools last school year. And they're very good about taking a lunch count every morning, like which kids are having hot lunch, which kids brought their lunch, and then they provide that information to the office. It would seem like that should be sort of a standard across the state at all levels, is it, at the very least, take a head count instead of making meals for every student on the roster. Take a head count in the morning and see who's eating at school and who's not.
That would be the sensible approach. The issue is, especially in bigger districts, there's the question of legality. When the ballot initiative said provide free lunches to all students, now the legality is, well, if they're not providing free lunches to all students because they're making 80 because 20 kids want their own lunch, it's a very weird place that we play school districts.
Interesting.
And I'm not, it depends on the school board, the school district, how they interpret it. Some don't want to take on that liability. They're afraid of lawsuits, so they go on the safe side and provide the lunches for everyone regardless. Some are smaller rural schools, so they understand. They're not going to get sued if they do a head count. But we operate different out here in rural Colorado. And our country math is just a little bit different than the cities who do it way different.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it from an interpretation standpoint, but I guess that's not why I'm in the state legislature. That's why I do this for a living instead. We've got just a couple of minutes left, Dusty. Real quick, want to touch on the AI discussion. What is it that you guys will be covering as it pertains to AI at the special session?
Yeah, so we have a bill that's going to go into effect. And every time I say we, for those listening, I'm talking about the state legislators as a whole, because it is we have to take the majority on what's happening. And I talk about majority votes in this point, not majority party. But in 23, there was a AI bill passed that put regulations onto how the algorithm can be used for businesses and schools when they're filtering information. There is a question on whether this algorithm now is discriminatory based on the information it's searching and how it then files this information away. To put it simple, if you use AI to filter out a whole bunch of resumes and you're saying, okay, anyone who doesn't have a master's in education, we're not going to look at, filter out everyone who hasn't clicked the master's box. That makes sense, but the question at play is how do we make sure we're not discriminatory based on we're hiring only women or only men or, you know, certain age groups. So this bill goes into effect January, and the argument is we need a delay for our smaller businesses, our rural areas, because they can't afford to implement this as fast as the state wants them to. So what we're looking here is just that if we either scrap that 23 bill and redo it, or if we allow for an extension, so we can come back next session and have more time to vet it out.
All right. Well, that seems pretty straightforward.
This is the least controversial issue of all of it. It's just we're on a time crunch.
That makes sense. One last thing. I know before we went on, you said you've got a bill in particular that you're working on for next session, the actual session. Tell me a little bit more about that.
It's called Pull to Tile, meaning I'm already working on bill drafts for next year. This one would be to make emergency medical service providers, so our EMTs and paramedics, postal service in Colorado. We do not, so we have, you know, dispatch, fire, law enforcement, they're all essential services here in Colorado, but EMS is not yet. So I want to make sure we fix that.
Okay, I'm going to put my my flabbergastedness on the surface here. I'm absolutely shocked that EMS is not considered an essential service.
Yes, and it's something, I mean, as a former EMS myself, and I'm looking at getting recertified, I've heard of this in the industry. It's not okay. They're not. There are so many things that benefit from if we have a giant mass issue. Essential services can pull from the state fund. We're seeing it right now with all the fires. If they need to pull in more information because we have a huge safety issue with these fires, firefighters and now police who are managing the roads, if they need it because they have so many people volunteer on the ground, but they might need resources, can pull without a special session, without needing, you know, any special privilege that can be delayed by weeks or months, they can pull these funds. Well, you also have EMT crew on site, but they cannot pull into these funds. You also have special protections for fire and police if something happens to them in a situation that's supposed to be closed off on a, you know, during weather. We have roads that say do not enter, but essential service can. Well, if an EMT enters that road and something happens to them or their vehicle, technically they could have a lawsuit because they're not covered because they're not essential.
Well, like I said, I am absolutely just gobsmacked that that is the case. I grew up, my mom was an EMT. She taught the EMT course at NJC here in Sterling for a number of years. So I've grown up around the industry and grown up around the people in the industry. And I can't think of many more essential services than those who work as emergency medical service technicians. That's just... That seems like almost a slap in the face to the industry, considering they're just as important as firefighters and police are.
No, exactly. I mean, and unfortunately, I mean, it's the EMTs, and I say dispatch, but they, in 2023, did get classified as essential, so they're now covered. But those tend to be the first responders that are forgotten about. Most of the credit always goes to fire or law enforcement. So, yeah, it is a slap in the face. They've been forgotten, kind of pushed to the side. It's been an ongoing issue, but it's something that people keep saying, we'll get to it later, we'll get to it later, or they just forget about it. And that's it. For me, it's not okay.
I could not agree more. I don't generally get worked up by things, but that one kind of worked me up a little bit. You kind of got my blood boiling a little bit this morning, Dusty.
Yeah, you know, and this is one that is not going to be, you know, it should not be a party issue. It really should just be a, you know, let's do what's best for people as a whole. It's not a rural versus, you know, urban issue, which there are very few of those. And what I want to do for our, you know, EMS providers, part of this bill too, and I'm sure you know with your mom, if you have a EMS certification, you are obligated to stop when you see an accident, regardless if you're on duty or not. And I want to make that as a people can now do that if they feel comfortable to. Because if your mom's traveling at 2 a.m. on a very sketchy road, does she want to stop for a vehicle that looks like it could be a DUI wreck from five gentlemen? Does she feel safe? They should have that discretion if they're going to put themselves in danger off duty. So we're not putting our first responders at any more risk than they have to be.
Well, and that just makes sense. I mean, when you're on duty and there's a situation where potential threat exists, one of the first things you're taught as an EMS personnel is to ensure that the scene has been secured and that it is safe to tend to the patients. So if you're required to do that on duty, I don't know why you would put yourself in danger off duty.
Well, and when you're on duty, you're tapped to a mic, you have, you know, your vehicle, they know your location, people have units coming to you, you usually have law enforcement fire on standby if they're not already at the scene, you're a single entity traveling on the road afterwards, you're not in all that, you might have just been coming off the shift, you're too tired to respond effectively anyways, there are all these cases that I really do want to make sure that we're making, we're not wearing out our EMS crew more than we have to, and that we're not making them do things that kids are not safe.
Well, I think those are excellent ideas, excellent points. And like you said, they should be fairly easy to get through. They don't come across as partisan issues. They're not something that impacts rural versus urban. I mean, it feels like pretty straightforward legislation, but gosh, that's That's almost unheard of nowadays.
It, you know, and it is election year, so, you know, we'll probably, both of us will get frustrated when we find some stupid little pebble into this that they're very upset about, and then they're making it a party issue or whatever. I hope not. I hope it's just a easy, we're going through and fixing a statue kind of thing. But we'll see. Time will tell.
I'll keep my fingers crossed. Dusty, we're out of time, but thank you so much for the insight and the updates this morning. Always a pleasure to talk to you and get a little background on what's happening at the state capitol. And I look forward to following up next month and see where we're at.
I look forward to it. And until then, have a good time and enjoy the cooler weather coming.
Yes, indeed. Once again, State Representative Dusty Johnson, our guest here on Northeast Colorado Talks on Farm Radio 1010 KSIR and KSIR.com.